I don't remember how many, I don't know how many Christmases you ever experienced as an unbeliever. Maybe none that you can remember. I had 18 Christmases as an unbeliever. 18 Christmases, maybe 19. I think it was 19. And for most people who don't know Christ, Christmas is a scandalous disappointment. It's a scandalous disappointment. In other words, for many, the Christmas season is sort of this annual hoax that things will finally get better, but never actually do. You see, for millions, Christmas is filled with these fantasy-fueled expectations that the Christmas spirit, whatever that is, will somehow give them the joy they've always wanted but never actually experienced. And every year, the outcome is exactly the same. Nothing ever changes. Not really. You see, the false myth of Christmas that people buy into is that if they can make it look like the whimsical, hazy collage in their minds, that maybe, just maybe, they can somehow force the fantasy they've invented to become reality. Maybe this year things will be different. Maybe this year the husband will actually try to be a husband. Maybe the kids will stop rebelling. Maybe they'll come home this year. Maybe our marriage will be different. Maybe I'll be different. Maybe I'll get the promotion I've always wanted. Maybe I'll finally get the lover that I want, that I think will complete me. And the maybes pile up and the Christmases pile up. And yet when December 26th rolls around, people are left with the open mess of presents and the open mess of their lives still there. And the reason why nothing changes is because the Christ in whom they believe never got out of the manger. The reason why they were double-crossed again by Christmas is because the Christ in whom they believe is not the infinite God incarnated as a man. The reason why nothing is different for the world on December 26th is because the Christ in whom they believe is not a triumphant, victorious king who one day will return to this planet with the glory of 1,000 suns and who will rule the universe from a throne in Jerusalem. You see, that is who Christ is. And being infatuated with him is not merely the meaning and goal of Christmas. That is the meaning and goal of life. And beholding Christ as an invincible king is exactly what we see in our text this morning. Because this morning we dust off the ancient scroll of the book of Daniel, and we behold there in the text the secret blueprints of what God is doing in human history. And what he is doing in human history is bringing every moment of every event to its dramatic final conclusion, which is the triumphant return of the Messiah to the planet he created to establish his invincible kingdom. In other words, this morning, we're not only going to see God's sovereign control over human history, but also we're going to see what the end of the world will be, because it's not a secret. It's in the text. And you might be thinking that prophecy is a poor choice for a Christmas sermon. To which I reply, on the contrary, it is the ideal message for Christmas. Because prophecy has nothing to do with merely stirring our curiosity, but strengthening our very souls. Prophecy has nothing to do with futile speculations about what might happen, but is that which roots our deepest security in what will happen. And what will happen, mark my words, is that God himself will come to the earth that he created with the power of 1,000, 10,000 nuclear bombs. And he will put himself on display as the all-surpassing king and treasure of infinite worth forever and ever and ever. You see, that's a fact. That is certainty. I don't know if you like to gamble. I don't know if you ever visit casinos. I shouldn't have not opened that up. I don't know if you're a gambling person. This is not a gamble. This is going to happen. You see, I've got some bad news for you. That's really bad news for you. The world that you're inheriting is not friendly to people like you. You're not welcome here. I just want you to know that. And yet the worst thing you could possibly do would be to view yourself as some helpless victim in a corner. The worst thing you could possibly do would be to retreat into some Christian-only community. You know why? Because the Christ in whom you believe grew up and got out of the manger. Because the Christ in whom you trust was more than a man. Because the Christ in whom you have placed your love and your affection and your devotion, he will single-handedly end the reign of terror in the world. Which means that my gift to you this year is God himself in human flesh. You're welcome. So turn to Daniel chapter 7. Daniel 7 verses 1 through 14. And I'm going to read it, or at least most of it, and then we'll launch. Daniel chapter 7. It's kind of after the big prophets of Isaiah, Jeremiah, Lamentations is in there, Ezekiel, then it's Daniel. Starting in verse 1, Daniel writes, "In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel saw a dream and visions in his head while on his bed. Then he wrote the dream, a complete account he related. Daniel said, 'I was looking in the visions of the night, and behold, four winds of heaven were stirring the great sea, and four great beasts came up out of the sea, each one being different from the other. The first one was like a lion, and it had the wings of an eagle on its back. And I was seeing until its wings were plucked off, and it was lifted from the earth, and it was set on legs like a man, and it was given the heart of a man. And behold, a second beast, another one resembling a bear, and it stood on one side, and three ribs were in its mouth between its teeth, and it was spoken to, arise, devour much flesh. After this, I was looking, and behold, another one like a leopard, and it had the four wings of a bird on its back, and this beast had four heads, and dominion was given to it. After this, I was seeing in the visions of the night, and behold, a fourth beast, being terrifying and alarming and extremely mighty, and it had great teeth of iron, crushing and devouring, and the rest with its feet it was trampling down, and it was different from all the beasts which were before it, and it had 10 horns. And I was considering, pondering the horns, and behold, another horn, a little one, came up between them. And three of the horns were ripped out before it, and behold, this horn had the eyes of a man and a mouth speaking great boasts." Skip down to verse 13. "I was seeing in the visions of the night, and behold, with the clouds of heaven, one like a son of man was coming, and he came up to the Ancient of Days and was presented before him. And to him was given dominion and majesty and a kingdom, and all the peoples, nations, and tongues shall serve him. His dominion is a dominion of eternity, which shall not be taken away, and his kingdom shall not be destroyed." Believe it or not, I'm going to preach on that. So here's where we're going. This morning, I want you to see from our text five features of the king. Five features of the king that will make your Christmas most profoundly meaningful. Five features of the king designed to make your Christmas most profoundly meaningful. But before we see our first feature of the king, you have to understand that what chapter 7 is a vision. It's a vision. In this vision, Yahweh pulls back the curtain of mystery, and he displays his absolute sovereignty over kingdoms and realms and empires and even over the shifting of entire civilizations. And Daniel begins in verse 1. Look at the text. He says, "In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel saw a dream and visions of his head on his bed." Notice that Daniel remembers with exact detail when he received this vision. You see, having a vision was not like being high or having a hallucination. No, Daniel was given full mental capacity to see and to remember and to record and to interpret the dream with absolute precision. And you notice that Daniel saw the dream in his head while lying on his bed. This poor guy, he's just minding his own business, sleeping in the middle of the night, when all of a sudden God turns Daniel's mind into a theater in which he projects his sovereign plan. And when he woke up, no doubt with heart pounding and hands trembling, he picked up a pen and wrote it down. And 2,600 years later, we are here to enjoy it. And what you have to understand is that some of the things predicted here have already happened, and some of them are about to happen, maybe even in your lifetime. And so Daniel launches into his vision in verses 2 and 3. Look at what he says. I was looking in the visions of the night, and behold, four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea, and four great beasts came up out of the sea, each being different from the other. And you know without question that visions oftentimes contain metaphors and symbols and poetic language. And here Daniel sees four winds of heaven stirring up the great sea. Out of that sea come four massive beasts, each one being different from the other. And you might be thinking, it is impossible to interpret this. There's no way we're going to figure out what this means. This could mean anything. And you're right. It would be impossible had Daniel himself not interpreted the dream for us down in verses 15 through 28. And there's three things that we need to know. Number one, what are the four winds of heaven? Number two, what is the great sea? Number three, what or who rather are the four massive beasts which rise out of the sea? So first, the beasts. According to verse 17, that's four kings and their kingdom. We're talking about people. The great sea is a picture not of the Mediterranean Sea, but of the sea of humanity, or actually more precisely, of the toxic ocean of wicked humanity out of which these kings rise and exercise their dominion. Are you following me? And we know that that's true because verse 17 actually interprets the sea as humanity. Look what it says. These are four kings who shall rise from the earth. From the earth and from the sea are parallel. They're equated. And as for the four winds of heaven that stir up the great sea, very likely that's a way of describing the sovereign power of God that governs all that comes to pass, including nations and realms and empires and the shifting of entire civilizations. And you notice that the four beasts which rise out of the sea, they're described as great, which means they are great both in their power and in their size. These beasts are not rodents. These are not pets. These are not tame, domesticated animals. No, these are great beasts. These are massive and dreadful and terrifying, which means that the four kingdoms they represent are absolutely devastating. What you have to know about the book of Daniel is that this is not the first time that these four kingdoms have appeared in a vision in this book. In fact, way back in chapter 2, King Nebuchadnezzar, of all people, the king of Babylon, he was given a dream about these very same four kingdoms. And the point here is that God is revealing, get this, in chronological order, which kingdoms would have the world power on the earth. So he's displaying for us hundreds of years before it happened who would have the world power on the earth. And in chapter 2, we are told that this first kingdom is none other than the kingdom of Babylon. Look at verse 4. The first beast was like a lion, and it had the wings of an eagle. I was looking until its wings were plucked out, and it was lifted from the earth, and it was set down on the legs of a man. You see here that the kingdom of Babylon is pictured like a lion. And even as Daniel was writing this, the Babylonian kingdom, they were the heavyweight champion of the world in that day. This kingdom was a killing machine, which is why it's portrayed as a lion. But you notice, this is no ordinary lion, because this lion had the wings of an eagle. It's not only a violent predator, it is swift to devour its prey. You can still find carvings of lions with wings on ancient Babylonian ruins. Everyone who read this knew exactly who this was referring to. But then you notice in verse 4, before Daniel's eyes, the wings are violently ripped off the back of the lion, and it's given the legs and the heart of a man. And very likely that's referring to the time when Yahweh punished Nebuchadnezzar for his pride. Remember that in chapter 4? 7 long years God inflicted him with insanity and dementia. But then Daniel sees the next king to reign after Babylon. Look how it's pictured in verse 5. And behold, another beast, a second one resembling a bear, and it stood on one side, and it had 3 ribs in its mouth between its teeth. The next kingdom is pictured as a bear. And even though Daniel doesn't tell us explicitly who this is, historically we know exactly who this is. You know who it is? This is the Medo-Persian Empire. That's modern-day Iraq and Iran and Syria and Turkey, in case you were wondering. And no, my guess is there's not one single person in this room gives a rip about the ancient Persian Empire. Why would you? But in their day, they were a massive and fierce and terrifying kingdom, which explains why a bear is chosen to represent them. And in just a few years from when Daniel wrote this, the Persian Empire was going to march through the city gates of Babylon, and they were going to level it to the ground. This empire lasted for over 200 years. It stretched all the way from Egypt, all the way to India, even up into Russia. I don't know if you know this or not. There are 57 million square miles of real estate on the earth, and in their day, the Persian Empire owned 5 million square miles of it. This place was, they were unbelievable. And you notice, don't you, that the bear has 3 ribs in its mouth? That refers to its most well-known military victories over Egypt and Babylon and Asia Minor. They crushed even the most powerful nations on the earth like little insects on the pavement. And then an unnamed voice, probably Yahweh's, commands him to rise and to devour much flesh. That's a command to kill and to conquer. They were commanded to devour, and devour they did, slaughtering their way around 3 continents, establishing their bloody kingdom with incredible brutality. But every kingdom has their limit, even the Persian one. And so Daniel pictures the next kingdom to take their place, and somehow, some way, this one is even more terrifying and more ferocious. Look at verse 6. After this, I was looking, and behold, another one like a leopard, and it had four wings of a bird on its back, and this beast had 4 heads, and dominion was given to it. You know, you don't have to be a history scholar to know that the next kingdom to take over the world was who? The kingdom of Greece. Kingdom of Greece. And here they're pictured as a leopard. And you know what leopards are known for? 2 things: speed and a thirst for blood. Leopards are fast, but this leopard is unstoppable because it has the 4 wings of an eagle, of a bird on its back. Without question, what this refers to is the lightning speed with which Greece took over the entire world under the insatiable rule of Alexander the Great. Within 10 years, 10 years, Greece conquered Spain and France and North Africa and the entire Middle East up into Russia, all the way over to India. And they killed so fiercely and so quickly and so ferociously that when it was all over, legend has it that Alexander looked and he wept because there were no more lands to conquer. But no doubt you're wondering why this kingdom has 4 heads. That's not just to make it sound scary. See, heads in Scripture represent authority, represent rulers. And what is so staggering to know is that after Alexander's death, at the age of 32, by the way, that his kingdom was divided up into four regions, each one being ruled by a different empire. That did not happen till the 2nd century BC. Daniel is writing in the 6th century BC, centuries before this ever happened, which means you have two choices as to what you can do with the book of Daniel. You can blow it off, just write it off as this worthless thing that was written after the fact to give the impression of something supernatural, or you can view the book of Daniel as actual predictive prophecy revealing what God has ordained, showing that God is a God who controls human history, including that petty little tyrant over in North Korea. For 188 years, Greece looked absolutely unstoppable. That is, until a kingdom called Rome came and took their place. We see it in verse 7. This one's the most terrifying at all. Look at the text. Verse 7, after this, I was looking in the visions of the night, and a fourth beast, being terrifying and frightening and extremely mighty, and it had great teeth of iron, devouring and crushing, and the rest that was left over, it trampled with its feet, and it was different from all the beasts which were before it, and it had 10 horns. The details here are chilling, aren't they? I mean, this beast here defies any zoological category. At least the other ones kind of sort of resembled something that we have on this planet, but this thing doesn't look like anything we've ever seen. Daniel has never seen anything like this. Daniel says that it's frightening. It was a fearsome beast that struck fear into the hearts of its opponents. Next, he calls it terrifying. It was so intimidating and deadly and dangerous that it terrified those it encountered. And finally said that it was extremely mighty. It possessed a brute force that for centuries made it seem impervious and indestructible. And then Daniel goes on to describe why it's so terrifying. Large iron teeth protrude from its mouth with which it crumbles and crushes and devours its prey. And if there's anything left over of its victims, it crushes them with its feet. And this thing is brutal and heartless, which is a pretty good way to describe the Roman Empire, because the Roman Empire was fierce in appearance, unparalleled in power, insatiable in appetite, superior in size. There was just nothing like it on the earth. And in 146 BC, they superseded Greece as the heavyweight champion of the ancient world. They possessed a power and a longevity that the world has never even seen. And did you know that the last emperor died, the last Roman emperor died in 1453 AD? Compute. That's 1,600 years where the Roman Empire was on the earth. That has never happened. That has never been done. No one has ever done that. But you noticed, didn't you, that this beast, more scary than any horror film that has ever been made, this beast has 10 horns which come out of its head. And verse 24 tells us that these horns, they represent kings, 10 more kings, 10 kings that rise out of the Roman Empire. And these are not kings of the past. Get this. These are kings of the future. Maybe even kings who exist right now. But I'm just going to tell you, I forbid you from trying to guess who this is. It's way too early to thumb through the newspaper to try to start looking for fulfillments. But you need to see what happens in verse 8. Look at the text. It says, I was considering the horns, just like we are. I was considering the horns, and behold, another horn, literally a small one, came up between them. And three of the horns were ripped out before it, which means the horn grew and grew and grew until it ripped out the others which were before it. And behold, this horn had the eyes of a man and a mouth speaking great boasts. I mean, this thing just keeps getting weirder by the minute, doesn't it? And all of a sudden, Daniel sees this other horn grow out of the head of this fearsome beast, and it grows and gets so massive that it rips out these other horns. And do you know what this is? Do you know what we're seeing here? This is an apocalyptic preview of what is going to happen in world history. That's what this is. There's a world ruler coming. I don't know if you know this or not. There's a world ruler who is coming one day in the future. And he will rise up and he will have absolute global domination. His kingdom will put the Roman Empire to shame. And although he's going to start small, he's going to be a little horn, as it were, he will rise and he will have an undisputed reign of terror over the entire planet. And in the Bible, the only ruler who fits that description is who? The Antichrist. And in the book of Revelation, he is referred to simply as the beast. Listen to Revelation 17, verses 12 and 13. John has this vision of, you guessed it, a beast with 10 horns. Look what he says. It's being interpreted for him. He's quoting the angel, quoting him. And he says, the 10 horns which you saw, those are 10 kings. And they have not yet received a kingdom. But they shall receive authority as kings for 1 hour with the beast. And these kings, they shall have one purpose, and they shall give their power and their authority to the beast. Notice what it said. These 10 kings are going to join the Antichrist in sort of this coalition of evil, this anti-Christian united coalition of evil. And verse 13 says that they give their power and their authority to the beast, which means they give him their military and their money to be at his disposal. When he arrives, he will unleash a Satan-inspired master plan. He will hijack the entire planet and he will slaughter anyone who does not bow down to him. And in Revelation 17, the next verse goes on to say this about the Antichrist and his 10 puppet kings. It says, these, the kings and the Antichrist, these shall wage war with the Lamb, and the Lamb shall overcome them. The Lamb shall conquer them because he is the King of kings and the Lord of lords. See, the Antichrist will unleash terror that the world literally has never known. The entire planet will be under the seemingly undisputed dominion of the Antichrist. And yet, when the King of Kings comes to claim his throne, the Antichrist will actually have the audacity to think that he actually stands a chance. And yet, little does he know that when he squares off against King Jesus, that he will be publicly beheaded and sent to hell live on CNN. And then everyone will know who the true king is. And, by the way, speaking of the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords, that brings us to our first feature of the king. First feature of the king, and now I'm down in verses 13 and 14. And the first feature of the king is this. If you're taking notes, number one, it is his divine origin. His divine origin. And I'll have you know that Daniel chapter 7, verses 13 and 14, these are the most quoted verses in the entire New Testament. Did you know that? Which probably means you should know them. You should probably read them at Christmas time or whenever. Because you see, the terrors of ISIS, of Kim Jong-un in North Korea, the imminent threat of nuclear holocaust should all be viewed through the lenses of Daniel chapter 7, verses 13 and 14. And the reason for that is because what we see here, rather who we see here, is the one who has absolute undisputed dominion over everything. And his first feature is found in verse 13. Look at the text. In the previous verses, Daniel just saw the execution of the Antichrist. And here he says, I was looking in the visions of the night, and behold, with the clouds of heaven, one like a son of man was coming, and he came up to the Ancient of Days and was presented before him. You don't have to know your Bible that well to know that who we see here is the long-awaited king, the Messiah, the deliverer that the entire Old Testament had been pointing to. For centuries, the people of Israel have been getting these little glimpses of this one who would arrive in the future, who would be the great high king, the great deliverer. It started all the way back in Genesis chapter 3, verse 15. Adam and Eve blew it. They just exploded the world with their sin and with their consciences aching and hearts breaking, God tells them, no, do not fear, because one is coming and he will crush the head of the serpent. And through all the scriptures, we're looking for the great serpent crusher, and here he appears again in Daniel chapter 7. And Daniel's given this divine security clearance to see into the very throne room of God, to see this strange ceremony taking place. And you notice that when the Messiah arrives on the scene, you notice that he comes with the clouds of heaven. Do you see that in the text? He arrives with the clouds of heaven. You know why that's significant, don't you? See, the point is not just to create a dramatic atmosphere. No, the point is to indicate that a divine being, that God himself, has just walked into the room. Because in the Old Testament, the appearance of the presence of God is dramatically marked by clouds. You see, the clouds of heaven indicate the source and the origin and the identity of this king. How many of you have seen The Wizard of Oz? You see that? Okay, good. So this illustration is not pointless. It's not wasted on you. Remember at the end when the great wizard appears, and he appears to all those trembling people, Dorothy and the Scarecrow, and he comes in fire and smoke and lights and sound and fury. But was it real? No, it was just cheap stage special effects to give the mere impression of greatness. But here, when the Son of Man appears, accompanied by the very clouds of heaven, it's all designed to show his absolute supremacy. Make no mistake, the king for whom we are all waiting is not merely a man. He is God, the infinite, eternal, uncaused, uncreated, unchangeable, unalterable, sovereign God of the universe. Jesus Christ is God. Second feature of the king, number two, his supreme title. His supreme title. Look again at verse 13. Daniel says, I was looking and I saw one like, here it is, a son of man, and he was coming. Christ is identified as a son of man, and that's more than just a description. That's a title. And that phrase, son of man, by itself, that is nothing significant. That's just a Jewish way, a long-handed way of describing a human being. But notice exactly what it is that Daniel says. He didn't see a son of man. He saw one like a son of man. And that word like is a real game changer, because it tells us that who Daniel saw was similar to a human being, but not exactly like. Who he saw was like a man, but simultaneously more than a man. And we know that because in the very next verse, this man is worshipped by the nations. He's worshipped and he receives an everlasting kingdom. And the use of this title, which emphasizes humanity, is just so fitting for the Messiah. Because as the Old Testament progresses and reveals more and more of God's plan, it becomes profoundly clear that who the Messiah is would be God himself in human flesh, and he would come to physically and publicly and openly and visibly rule the universe from a throne in Jerusalem. Well, how would he do that? How would God do that? By incarnating himself as a human being. That's how. And this title should sound really, really familiar to you, because this is Christ's favorite designation of himself, used 84 times in the Gospels. And when he called himself the Son of Man, he was unmistakably taking this title on himself. Did you know that at his mock ridiculous trial hours before his death, when they asked him, are you the Son of God or not? Are you the Messiah or not? Which verse did he quote? This one. And they killed him for it. And yet the way that Jesus used this term really befuddled the people of his day. Because he said things like this: the Son of Man must suffer and be rejected, and he must be killed. Now wait a second. Wait a second. The king must be killed. The Messiah must be massacred, the deliverer must die. That's impossible. That cannot happen, or so they thought. But what they did not know is that that title, Son of Man, is a gloriously paradoxical title. It contained within it both his first coming and second coming simultaneously. It was simultaneously incarnational and apocalyptic. You see, when Christ used this title of himself, he wanted people to know that first he would be slaughtered, then he would have the supremacy. First he would be executed, then he would be exalted. First he would be killed, then he would be the king. First he would be the lamb that was slain, then he would be the lion that is slaughtered. That's who the Son of Man is. And then there's the third feature of the king. Number three, his majestic rewards. His majestic rewards. Keep in mind that Daniel was not looking at a painting, but a live action event. He's seeing a transaction unfold before his very eyes. Look what that is at the end of verse 13. It says, he came up to the Ancient of Days, that's God the Father, and was presented before him. Now picture the scene, if it is possible. The Son of Man accompanied by the clouds into the majestic throne room and in front of the entire population of the angelic beings sitting in the bleachers, he approaches the throne of the Ancient of Days. Do you know what's happening here? This is the coronation of the king. He's being coronated as the king. He is receiving that which is his right to possess, namely the universe and everything in it. And we see what his rewards are. We see what he is given in verse 14. Look at the text. And to him was given dominion and majesty and a kingdom. Sounds familiar, doesn't it? To him was given dominion and majesty and a kingdom. That sounds an awful lot like Matthew 28:18. All authority was given to me in heaven and on earth. Same transaction. And you notice that the first reward on the list is dominion. Dominion means authority and power and the right to rule. Dominion means that Jesus Christ is supreme above all things. He is superior to all things. He is sovereign over all things. Nothing takes place in human history unless it has been ordained by the Son of Man. Every square inch is under his divine jurisdiction. Make no mistake. We do not give Jesus Christ authority over our lives. He has it whether we like it or not. Which means that everything in your lives is very intentional. According to the sovereign pleasure of Christ, he has brought you here to this very precise moment of your life. So there's a sense of destiny even about this time in your lives which have been planned and prepared by the Son of Man, the Messiah, to come. And then you notice that Christ is given majesty. The term in Aramaic has the idea of precious, that which is glorious, that which has worth and value and significance and beauty. And what you have to understand is that Christ here, he's not being made glorious. His glory is being made obvious. He's not being given infinite worth. His own inherent infinite worth is being displayed for everybody to see and to acknowledge. And then finally, the reward of the Son of Man is that he gets a kingdom. He gets a kingdom. And what you have to understand is this is not the general, overarching, universal kingdom by which God controls the universe. It is that, but it is not only that. Now, when it says kingdom here, it's referring to a specific, literal, physical kingdom to be established on this very planet, because mark my words, Jesus Christ will one day physically and visibly and publicly return to earth, and he will rule the universe from a throne in Jerusalem. And if you have been purchased by him, if you are owned by him, you will be there to enjoy it. The fourth feature of the king. This, number four, his global subjects. His global subjects. Because if Christ has a kingdom, that means he's a king. And if he's a king, that means there are subjects over which he rules. And we come to find out that who Jesus Christ will rule is every single person on the planet. Look at verse 14 again. And to him was given dominion and majesty and a kingdom, and all the peoples, nations, and tongues shall serve him. Did you notice? All the peoples, all the nations, all the tongues. When Christ comes to claim his throne, there will not be one nation that will claim independence. There will not be any rogue empires or competing kingdoms or dynasties. Not one tribe, not one clan will be outside of his rule and reign and concern and love. He will be king over all the earth because every tribe and tongue and nation and people belong to him. And have you ever read in Psalms where it talks about the global worship of God? Have you ever read that in the Psalms? And have you ever been like, when is that possibly supposed to take place? I mean, have you ever read Psalm 67? Let the peoples praise you, O God. Let all the peoples praise you. Let the nations be glad and sing for joy, for you shall rule the nations on the earth and you will guide them. I mean, is that just being optimistic? Is that just describing what we would like to see happen but probably never actually see happen? Or does it have a fulfillment? And it does. That psalm, the prayer of that psalm will be answered when King Jesus returns. There'll be global worship of the King. And do you feel the implications of this? Do you feel what this is saying? That means people from Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, and Iraq, and Iran, and Egypt, and North Korea, and Somalia, and Afghanistan, and the Czech Republic, and China, and Japan, the hardest countries in the world, will be there, and they will have allegiance to King Jesus. And notice what the nations will do. It says they will serve him. Le yiflachun, the nations will serve him. But wait a second, they will serve him? They're going to serve the Messiah. In what way will they serve him? The same way people serve their dictators, will Christ be this lazy, pot-bellied tyrant lounging at a banquet table while his fearful slaves do his bidding? Is that the kind of service that's being spoken about? No, the idea that's being spoken of here is worship. It's worship, which means in that day when Christ sits on his glorious throne, the Son of Man will be worshiped and prized as a treasure. It means that the ends of the earth will be preoccupied and infatuated with him as the gravitational center of everything. In that day, the worship will be total. His subjects will be loyal. His glory will be global. It will be, and he will be all that we have been waiting for. And then finally and quickly, the fifth feature of the King is his everlasting kingdom. Number five, his everlasting kingdom. I don't know about you, but this is almost too much to take in. Our capacity, there's so much majesty on the page. Our capacity to hear anything else is being stretched to its limits, and yet Daniel's not done. There's one more thing on the page. Look at the end of verse 14. It says, his dominion is an eternal dominion which shall not be taken away, and his kingdom which shall not be destroyed. The divine resume of the King is increasingly impressive. First Daniel says, literally in Aramaic, his dominion is a dominion of eternity. And if eternity means that Jesus Christ is sovereign, that means that he will always be the King. He's not some petty elected official who have a limited term in office. He will never be voted out or impeached or asked to resign. And you notice that it says that his dominion shall not be taken away. Think about what that means. Caesar, stabbed to death by his own men. Lincoln, shot in the head by a troubled psychopath in the back of a theater. Kennedy assassinated in broad daylight by a gunman from a shop window, surrounded by all this controversy that maybe the government was in on it too. And But what you have to know about Christ is that he will never be gunned down by a sniper. He will never be taken out by a car bomb. There will never be a successful mutiny or political overthrow against him. No, his rulership, his sovereignty, his authority will be perpetual and it will be eternal. And then notice he has one more thing. His kingdom will not be destroyed. All things must come to an end except when King Jesus comes to establish his kingdom, it will not be destroyed. Neither enemy armies or competing empires nor internal corruption or scandals will ruin the kingdom of Christ. Think about it. People will still be writing books in eternity future. And the history books to be written after Christ returns, there will always be a beginning date to his reign, but there will never be an end date. It will always be blank. So those are five features of the king. And I still have three implications. Because, lest you think that, well, you know, this is all prophetic, sort of theological stuff. I'm off the hook to have to actually apply anything. Think again. Here's very quickly three implications. Number one, three implications of these glimpses of the king. Number one, and I'm just going to be honest with you, I get angry. Not just in general, specifically. I'm just angry, period. Let's close. I become angry at Islamic extremists who torture and execute our comrades. Don't you? Doesn't that make you angry? Somalia, Iraq, Syria, other Muslim countries. Sometimes I just say in my heart, how long, oh Lord, how long until you avenge their blood? I want to see vengeance. Don't you? And yet what soothes my anger is Daniel chapter 7. Because what Satan and his demons and all Islamic terrorists need to know is that their days are numbered. The enemies of Christ are on borrowed time. And every moment of their existence is on loan from King Jesus. And if they do not repent, he will strike them dead with the breath of his mouth. That is a Christmas worthy meditation. Number two, implication takes the form of a question. Do you not feel the urgent missionary opportunity that Christmas brings? Do you not feel this? We literally exist for the imperial majesty of Jesus Christ and for the glory of his invincible sovereign empire. And so let's make it plain in our homes and to the world that what Christmas is not the fantastical birthday party for a tribal deity, but a celebration of when God came to earth as a man. Let's tell the world with unblushing clarity and conviction that Christ came not to put presents underneath the tree, although there's nothing wrong with presents underneath the tree, for the record, but that Christ entered into the hay and manure of a broken world desperately in need of fixing. Finally, number three, the best way to make your Christmas most meaningful is to not be that guy who grumbles against presents and tinsel and bells and mistletoe and the supposed pagan roots of the Christmas tree. The best way to maximize your Christmas is to keep yourself vigilant and those around you, to keep them vigilantly from everything that has become Christmas except for the God. Who arrived as a baby, who will return as a king. You see, Christmas is not about fulfilling holiday expectations, but it's about celebrating the overwhelming accomplishments of Christ for hell-deserving sinners. Close with this. There's not one thing in the Bible that says we have to celebrate Christmas. Not one. But if we're going to celebrate it, let's do it right. Let's go all the way. And let's be infatuated by the one who is the most admirable and interesting and glorious and exceptional person in the universe. Because that's not only the meaning and goal of Christmas, that is the meaning and goal of life. Let's pray. Oh Lord, there is too much to take in. It's too much, Lord. There's too much. We bit off more than we could chew. We can't possibly understand that which we have received so far. And Lord, I pray that as muddled as this may have been, as confusing as this may have been, as inadequate as it most certainly was, I plead with you that your word would sharpen and clarify and focus our vision of who Jesus Christ is so that our worship may be authentic and genuine. We want affections for him, Lord. And so as we express those final affections in song, may you transform not only today, but our Christmas as well, so that Christ receives the place that he deserves, which is the King whose kingdom will never have an end. And it's in his matchless name we pray. Amen.